Welcome to the Footmarks podcast. Today we're going to be having a look at how Test match cricket has changed, or the batting, I suppose, specifically. Kind of all Test match cricket, if we're being honest. And for that, we have a special guest. He's been hiding out in our YouTube comments for a long time. Sort of, he's been at once maybe the biggest help that the Good Errors Network has ever had, and also our greatest troll. Would you like to introduce yourself, sir?
Hi, I'm Varun Alvakonda. I'm one of Jared's minions at Good Areas. Like, I usually provide stats.
Is that your official stats? I might, maybe, if we ever get business cards made up, just get head minion for you. So Varun, head minion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Minion. All right, we've got this one. And I wanted to ask you, because I think you sent the original the original graphic that really started this piece. And I can't remember if I asked you for it or not, but you gave me the entire history of all the dismissals in cricket in like in a graph. Did you come up with that, or was that like a conversation we'd had?
I think it was a conversation we had. I think it was just before the test season was starting, the home test season. And then it's one of those things where you just randomly ask me for a chart, and then we just talk about it for a bit, and then we just forget about it. Because there was so many pieces we were doing during the home test series. So we just didn't have a chance to go back to it.
Yeah, I remember, because like sometimes you'll send stuff in the group or whatever, and I'll be like, oh, that's interesting, but I don't do anything with it. I remember like planning that one out and putting something in the system. So it must have tickled my fancies, whatever it was. But I don't remember why we actually looked it up. But the idea was to sort of, is there a really simple way of showing how much test match batting, or test match cricket, I suppose, has changed? And then I think the best one is the LBWs versus bold by decade. Is that the one that when you saw it, you went, oh, okay, I see now that the game has completely changed?
I was surprised by the LBW ones. Like bold, I'm not as surprised by, because I think a lot of earlier cricket was a lot of uncovered pitches. Mm. And then because there was also no DRS, I just assumed that we didn't have a lot of LBWs. But I was surprised LBW just had a very weird trend, but especially for fast bowling, where they went up to like the 90s and then we're seeing a decline.
Yeah.
I think
it looked like for fast bowling, it was going to go past bold, didn't it? And then now they're kind of almost tracking on the same bit. And then this decade, bold has gone out again. So it's really interesting.
And then
in general, it's funny that you say there was no DRS, so there'd be fewer LBWs, because there were actually like a lot of bad LBWs given. I always use Bruce Reid as the best example. Mm. I don't know if it was you looking at Bruce Reid recently or Cheyenne, but someone was looking at it in our group and just going, oh my God, these LBWs from the 80s and 90s are horrendous. And they really are. Because you've got like a lot of the LBWs, spinners never got LBWs in those days, right? Unless you played back. And the seamers would get them, but they would only get them like seemingly when the ball was flying over the top of the stumps. Or the other one that you would get is if anyone ever left the ball and the ball flicked their pads, the umpires would automatically just trigger them out. And if you look at the data on this, it's really interesting. Since DRS has come in, people leaving the ball and being giving out LBW has almost disappeared from the game, because the umpires used to just say, use your bat, son. They can't do that anymore because DRS doesn't care. So LBWs has changed quite a bit. Let's have a look at left-hand versus right-hand balls. I think this is a really, really interesting one. So were you shocked at how few left-handers there used to be, or did that make sense to you compared to now?
I knew there were few left-handers because obviously I spend a lot of time on this channel and we talk about that all the time, and how in the past there was almost no left-hand batters. But I was shocked that like it was like 5% at one point. I didn't realize it was that bad in test cricket. Whereas right now, I think since the 2000s, it's been about a third of the balls faced up by left-handed batters. That seems about right, I think. Seems just now, especially, seems to care a lot more about left-to-right balance than I think they historically did, right?
Yeah, I think there was always an idea of having a left-hander in your side. Like, if you could get one in. So I remember the talk about Ganguly was often that his value was more than his runs, because it gave them the ability to have a left-hander. In fact, I think when I was talking to Rahul Dravid, he was saying that if you go back, probably VVS Laxman should have batted ahead of Ganguly in the batting order. But one of the reasons they didn't do that is that they definitely needed a left-hander at the top, because quite often they didn't have any right at the top of their order. So I think teams have thought about it. It's obviously a lot different now. But I think the bigger difference is probably society, because I remember doing this research once and having a look at the fact that there was something like 2% or at the turn of the century, 2% of people identified as left-handed. And by the turn of the, that's at the start of 1900s. And by the end of the 2000s, it was at like 12%. Like that's five times as many left-handers. But I think the other issue is, it'd be interesting to see what you think about this. You know that I've forced all my kids to bat left-handed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the big issue I had, Varun, was that one of them actually turned out to be a left-hander, and I'm still thinking about turning him back to a right-hander now. But the reason I did it was not because specifically I thought it was an advantage, although I do think it's an advantage, but I did it more to do with the fact that I think that I was always standing on the wrong side of the bat, and I would have been a better left-hander than a right-hander. But we have decided that you stand on one side, you're right-handed, and you stand on the other side, you're left-handed. But the whole history of cricket tells us that that's not true, right? David Warner and Gilchrist and all these different people, right? Michael Clarke is another one. There's hundreds of them, right? Who actually could stand, who stand on the other side of the bat. So I wonder if there's a natural progression there as well of like, if you pick up the bat and you stand on the other side, perhaps people just stopped correcting you after a while and you started doing it. Was I think in the 1800s, if you stood on the left-hand side of the bat and you weren't a pure left-hander, I don't think you would have even been allowed to do it. So I wonder how much is that happening? And then the natural progression of we no longer think of left-handers like they've got some sort of handicap or anything, which clearly we did. I don't know if you've ever heard about this. You know that when people would go to school and if they would write right-handed in certain countries, if they would write left-handed in certain countries, they would be forced to change to their right hand.
Like, I think it was a thing in India like way back in the day, not now of course, but like 100 years ago, I think it was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, like and so
left,
I actually...
Yeah, your right hand was seen as the good hand and the left hand was seen as the bad hand.
Yeah, and there's medical stuff about this too, because in the old days, that's why we salute with our right hand and we don't salute with our left, because the left hand in many cultures was used to wipe your ass.
Yes. Right?
So you shake hands with the right hand and you salute with the right hand. So there are actual reasons why this happened, and it's really, really fascinating to see that, whereas... I think compared to, I'm trying to think of another sport, but I think compared to some other sports, I don't, like, let's say golf or baseball, I actually don't think right hand and left hand works the same way, because your hands work together a little bit more in cricket. Sense, yeah. Do you know what I mean? So you actually, if you want the top hand to be strong, it probably makes sense to be, if you're a right-handed about left-handed and a left-handed about it's about right-handed, and so I kind of understand it. But anyway, it's shocking.
I think I remember Matt Hayden saying in an interview once. I think his strong side of the body was facing the bowler. So when you're right-handed, it's your stronger side that's facing the bowler, right?
Yeah.
If you're right-handed batting left-handed, you're strong. Even if you're like, we always talk about things just your hands, but usually, like a lot of the time, especially if you don't go to the gym and fix the muscle imbalances, one side of your body might just be more developed than the other. Like if you're just starting off, if you split your body vertically in half, your right side might be a bit stronger than your left. So there is also a theory that, like, for a long time we thought your strong hand should be a bottom hand, whereas right now maybe there's a theory that the strongest side of the body should be facing the bowler. Your strong eye should also be facing the bowler, things like that. Do you think that plays a part as well?
Yeah, I think those are almost two separate things you just said too. I wonder if the strong side of your body is what, as you said, is important. So again, flipping it over might make more sense. But then sometimes your strong eye might not be your dominant eye. Like we're both we're not physicians or scientists on this. It could be that your right hand side of your body is strong and your left eye is the stronger one, right? At the same time, because you know.
I don't know if this is a myth, but like someone in my school once told me, like if you're right handed, your left eye is the stronger one, and if you're left, it's your right eye that's the stronger one.
Someone told you that at school. It has to be true.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's so many stupid things you hear. I don't know if it's true or not. I don't know if it's just like an urban myth that your school perpetrated.
You might not have read it in the book yet, but there's a really interesting chapter in the book about, is it about eyesight? No, it's about the technique. It's in the technique chapter where there was this guy who was, I want to say he was like a dentist or a doctor, but he did a lot of, he was a first-class cricketer. I think he played in England and then played in Australia as well. So he played first-class cricket in two different countries. And he was also talking about the fact about how when you do open face and you've got both eyes, it's actually not as strong as it is to have slightly more closed face and to use one eye. And he was talking about the way that telescopes work and the way that eyesights work. And he wasn't talking about it from a cricket perspective. I'm pretty sure his research was for like snipers or, you know, like maybe people in the army. So it's also, that's what, when we were saying before that, like, they weren't as full on with all this sort of stuff. There were people even way back when who were looking at all that sort of stuff and everything else. But there's no doubt that also, and we'll get to the last bit of this, I think, is the fact that some cultures produce left-handers and some cultures don't produce left-handers. Like Australia has always had a massive amount of left-handed batters, right? And India has not. And some of that is to do with the fact that off-spin is not the best method of bowling in Australia and off-spin is the best method of bowling in India. So there's all these little things. Anyway, there's our left-handers. The main point we were trying to make is there never used to be any, and now they're everywhere. They're like cane toads or something. I don't know. When we were looking at the right-handers specifically, I think this was against seam. It's really interesting. You could see the progression of what's the best way of putting it? You could see the progression of bowlers getting faster by the fact that stumpings almost completely go out of the game. And I remember. There's a bunch of these old I don't know what you call them, pace truthers, who believe that, like, no, Harold Larwood was definitely bowling at 90 miles an hour and all this sort of stuff.
I've seen them, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, if that was the case, he would have been like 4 yards quicker than any other bowler. And there doesn't seem to be any evidence of that period he was. But when you go back and you look at cricket, so we have a lot of footage of cricket from the 30s, 40s, into the 50s, you know, enough to be able to see the amount of times a wicketkeeper is up at the stumps. And it's really by the 1940s, 1950s that the wicketkeepers just are no longer standing at the stumps. That, for me, that has to be the bowlers just get a lot quicker at that point. Is that how you read it?
I think so. I think there's definitely some truth there, right? I think there is also a bit of, I think we talked about this on the channel before. You don't actually need to be like 100 miles an hour for people to be like terrified of you, because if you only ever face like 80 mile an hour quakes, someone who's bowling at 90 miles an hour will be terrifying to face. I think that's something which a lot of people would just miss. Everyone's like, oh, well, he was much faster than anyone else I've faced. I mean, that's true, probably, but I think that doesn't mean he's faster than the fastest bowlers now, right?
So yeah, I agree. I think that's the best way of explaining it.
I'm assuming the 80s and 70s, that's when we had the Tom O'Leary and the West Indies quakes just started coming through. That's when I think we had proper high pace coming through. I don't know. So we have had the odd bowler before that, but I don't know if that is always true in history.
Yeah, I think what happens is the front foot no ball, which is terrible for bowlers' bodies, is probably a lot better for pace and the way that it sort of sets up a catapult function. Whereas the old sliding method was probably not as set up for you to get maximum pace out of your bowling. And also, there's the natural evolution, right? Like if you look at some of the boots that the old bowlers were wearing, it would be very hard for them to be considered. You know, the old cricket boots back a long way used to have like steel caps or hard caps in the end. You don't want to, and these days bowlers cut out their toe holes, right? They don't want any pressure when they hit the crease. So I would assume there's only so much pace you can get out of that. And then you've got fitness and biomechanics and everything else. So it's really interesting to me that one of the main skills from the early part of cricket was being able to stand up to the stumps to seamers has basically disappeared. It's come back a little bit with the wobble ball just because we've seen it again. And obviously thanks to Johnny Bairstow for bringing back the being stumped to a seamer, right? But it does show you how different Bradman, and if you go back and look at footage of Bradman, quite often he's facing, you know, medium fast bowling with the keeper up at the stumps. Like, how often would Virat Kohli have faced that? Like, it would be rare for Steve Smith or Virat Kohli to face a genuine first-choice seam bowler with the keeper up at the stumps. Whereas for those guys in the third, you know, Jack Hobbs probably, I would have thought, the majority of the time he was batting, there was probably a wicketkeeper up to the stumps in his era, which just shows you how far those two things have changed as well. So we talked about this before, but I think this one is quite interesting, is that the right-hand batter versus right-arm seam, the fact that, so we've already said that the LBWs I've done that wrong, haven't I? I can't get my hands on the seam size. The LBWs and the seam.
This isn't it.
Yeah. Look at that. We nailed it. We're basically doing like Madonna now. So LBWs were always really, really low, and they've come up specifically in the 1980s, I think is when we see a lot more. I think I just want to talk about that on its own. So that's right arm seam bowlers to right handed batters. And I think the difference is that up until the 1980s, most bowling was outswing bowling. So you did get cutter bowlers, but the back in those days, so you may not know this story. I would have told it on a podcast, so you might have heard it before. But when Glenn McGrath came in Australia, everyone said he's not going to be successful. He doesn't have an outswinger, right? That was the big thing in cricket at that time was how good's his outswinger? Oh, he doesn't have an outswinger. I probably won't make it as a test cricketer. That was still happening in the 90s. But the 80s is where that changes because the West Indians all come in and hit the wicket. In the 70s, you look at bowlers, you still have people like Tomo, but you look at bowlers like Willis, Kapil Dev, Lilly, Hadley, all these sorts of guys, their main weapon was the outswinger, right? Is moving the ball away. And even someone like Willis, who's probably more of a hit the deck bowler, still would try and swing the ball away at times. So if you're a right arm bowler bowling to right handed batters and you're trying to swing the ball away, getting an LBW is really, really tough.
Sorry, like, I was going to ask you about the batters. Sorry, a bit of a tangent. But because West cricket was such an outswing dominant sport, is that why it was also easier to leave the ball? Because if you know ball is constantly leaving you, is it easier to just leave the ball? Because you know that if it lands on off stump, it's probably just going to miss it.
As a cricket journalist, I would travel up to 200 days a year. And I loved every part of it, except for one. This little evil pin here. Because I needed this to change my SIM card. And when you travel in cricket, you're quite often going from country to country. Don't get me started on how much this would annoy me in the West Indies. But even going from New Zealand to Australia, this pin was the worst. Well, with the Sally eSIM, they sort all of that out for you. They have an eSIM app that you install once, it's cheap, and it works in more than 160 countries around the world. No more turning up at an airport and lining up for a local SIM, trying to give over your passport and your details, and you just want to get in a taxi and go where you're going. No, Sally make it so much easier. You just download the app before you travel and you decide what kind of plan you actually need. Oh, and if you do that with our code, GOODAREAS, or one word, you get an exclusive 15% discount on Sally eSIM data plans. So go right now and download the Sally app and use the code GOODAREAS, or one word, at checkout and travel like a pro with Sally. Yeah, and if you look at, have you played much cricket?
Very little, very, very little.
So when a bowler is bowling right arm seam to you, and they're let's use Richard Hadley, he's the best example of this. Mm-hmm. So he would bowl as close to possible as the umpire. So he's probably releasing the ball from about over leg stump or off stump, however you look at it, from his end, right? If that ball starts to swing and he's pitching it on off stump, it's coming straight at you and you can see it start to curve away. Does that make sense? So you could see from the angle, the minute it starts to swing away, that's it. You don't have to worry about that ball at all at that point, right? So where some outswing bowlers and outswing bowlers were taught, like if you look at Dennis Lilly, watch what he does. He basically knocks the umpire's hat off as he can, because they were taught to bowl as close to stump as possible so they could keep bowled in LBW in the game, really, if nothing else. Whereas actually, now that we know a lot more about LBWs and angles, the best way to bowl outswing is from wide on the crease and to aim it in at the stumps. And then if it swings away, it might still hit the stumps, right? And you have the ability to get a bowled, an LBW, and a caught behind. So I think if you're batting and the ball is coming dead straight towards your eye line and you see it start to fade away, you don't have to play a shot at that point. Whereas if it's coming from a weird wide angle, it's much harder to pick up whether it's coming at your stumps or not. And I remember the first time in club cricket, I faced a guy who bowled really wide outswing. And I was like, this guy's not even quick and he's not even swinging it that much. And I don't know what to do. Whereas the minute someone would come close to the stumps, it's like, okay, that's pitched on off stump and he's bowling outswing. That's just going to miss the off stump by an absolute mile because he's got to curve the ball around. So I think that was a big part of it. And that's an LBW thing. It doesn't stop you getting bowled from Richard Hadley or Dennis Lilly or Kapil Dev or any of those guys. But the umpire is automatically thinking that your balls are curving away from the stumps. And so they're less likely to give you out LBW. Whereas now, again, what we know is if you pitch the ball on the line and it's moving away, it's almost never going to miss the stumps, right? Like you would have to jag a ball so violently or swing a ball so violently. And when you pitch the ball on middle and leg, even with a normal outswinger, chances are it's always hitting the stumps again. So yeah. I think that's where the LBWs have changed. But I thought that was a really, really interesting one that we have seen. And it's funny when you say the uncovered wickets playing a part, because I think you're right. And I think a lot of people would say that. But am I not mistaken here in going, if you're getting bowls from uncovered wickets, you should also get LBWs from uncovered wickets as well. There shouldn't be a difference. So I just think that in the old days, if you got far enough forward, you weren't given out LBW. Right. And if the ball sneaks through, you're bowled anyway. So it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a combination of those things. And the other thing I would say is that batters don't get that far forward anymore because umpires don't care if you're, you know, unless you're 2 meters down the wicket, umpires don't care. So I think things have changed a lot. Anyway, I thought that was really fascinating. Here's one I've been dying to ask you since we decided to do this podcast, because I haven't looked it up and I reckon you haven't looked it up either. So I'm going to try and get you to process this in real time. Did you look into why so many left-handers were out hit wicket in the, was it 1940s or 1950s to right-arm seam bowlers or to seam bowling in general? I
did not, because I honestly so the thing is, when I'm looking up all these stats, right, when you usually give me a list, I'm in a zone where my only purpose is just collecting stats and creating graphs. So a lot of the time I don't notice patterns. So the only time I notice patterns is if I know what I'm looking for and then I create it. So it's one of those
things. Or I send you a random message at the end going, look at this.
Yeah, exactly, right? So I just assume it's one of those. Okay, it's like a really low sample size. So I didn't think much of it, but all the comments were obsessed with it. You were obsessed with it. In the video, I was like, okay, man, I definitely missed something here. Because I completely missed it the first time.
So I can't work out. In fact, I should ask a couple of coaches. I can't think out. I'm seeing Bumble next week because I know he's a little bit later, but he'll be interesting as a lefty himself. I know he's from a different era, but I can't think of any reason why that would be the case. Why left-handers would be more likely to be able to hit wicket than right-handers. I can't think of a single thing. It's really interesting. So when we did our book, Clem Hill is not in the top 50 batters of all time. Apology to all the Clem Hill fans out there, which I think is just Abhishek Mukherjee and Dan Norcross, by the way. But one of the reasons Clem Hill is so important is because he's the first really, truly dominant left-hander, right? So his numbers are really similar to Trumper's, but he wasn't. My guess is he probably batted a little bit more like Graham Smith, and maybe he wasn't quite as pretty, and so people don't remember him. But he was quite an attacking player. I think you've shown me before he had a really good strike rate in that era as well, and was definitely a top quality player. There's no doubt about that. He's probably in the top 70 batters of all time without any question. But we don't really have that same kind of history on left-handers, so it's like, I know that Clem Hill is kind of the first dominant left-hander, but I don't really know who the next two or three are. And the majority of the great batters that come before World War II are right-handers. After World War II, we know there are more left-handers coming through consistently at that point. So I don't know if that plays a part and suddenly we start to, you know, there's just more left-handers. I don't know if it's, I think it was, oh, I'm trying to think, there was another cricket stato guy. It might be Jonas, who said, he said at one stage, he thought the thing that was most over-selected in cricket was left-handers. And that a lot of left-handers, when you look at their records, are nowhere near the records of right-handers. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean, okay, if they're worse, I get it. But why are they standing on their stumps or hitting their stumps? Like, I can't think of any technical reason why a left-hander is more likely to hit their stumps than a right-hander.
Yeah, it is very strange to think about.
There's no real reason for that. Anyway, I thought it was fascinating, and I know that
I just noticed in the 1940s, like also court keepers have been incredibly low for left-handed batters for some reason, which doesn't make sense to me.
I think the 1940s are very weird because a lot of Test match cricket is played in the 1940s, but there's a lot of if you look, there's a lot of weird outliery things that happen in the 1940s that don't follow on in the 1950s. So obviously Australia, New Zealand, England, I'm not sure about South Africa, but Australia, New Zealand, England would have, a lot of people would not have come back after the war and played. and in England specifically, and it might just be that England was maybe the most consistent team, and they don't, and they, and a lot of their players obviously just don't play again after the war, or take some time to get back into it, or whatever that may be. But yeah, I always find that 1940s is quite often an anomaly. So it could just be a fluke, right? And we're over annexing it. But it is funny when you look at the graph and you see it. The other thing that I found, and this is the one I'm going to call this the uncle matrix, right? You've got uncles and I've got uncles, and they will say the exact same thing. They'll be like, oh, no one can bat anymore. No one's got a good technique anymore. Techniques used to be great. When we look at the data, Warren, everyone used to get bowled. Like everyone yes. over the consistent history of test cricket used to get bowled. Do you think that suggests that techniques weren't quite as good? I know pitches have to have played a part, and I think pitches used to crumble a lot more, especially uncovered wickets. And I also believe that just in general, day 4 and 5 test match wickets were a little bit harder to bat on than they have ever been before, just because the technology in being a curator has changed. But there is an element of like, if these guys all had such great techniques, why are they getting bowled all the time? Am I alone on this, or do you also kind of agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it is definitely, we do always, I think, overblow, like how people always say like, oh, modern technique is just bad. And you look at all the averages, I'm like, if the techniques are so bad, why did they average the same as people did in the 90s? So like, is there something I'm missing here? This is one of those things where I'm like what you're saying and what I'm seeing don't make sense.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things in cricket where like the moment you have a narrative, I think it's really difficult to escape that narrative. I think the moment people have like a preconceived notion of, okay, IPL is the reason why test averages are down everywhere. Or like ODI cricket back in the day, right? It's a case of, everyone's just getting out because it's ODI cricket. Well, I think that's what, I don't really know why the bulge was as high as it was. I do wonder if there is just an element of this. We are looking at percentages, so I wonder if they didn't get dismissed in other ways, right? They weren't attacking, lofting the ball as much, so they might not have had as many outfield catches. So it might just be that everything we're seeing, that we see, like we may see more outfield catches now, just went to bulge. The umpires just being refusing to give LBW. It could just be a case of like, maybe it wasn't necessarily just bad techniques. It might just be that like a higher percentages of their dismissal just bowls because they didn't get out in other ways, right?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. Also, especially if we're going before World War II, if wicketkeepers are up at the stumps all the time, I would have assumed, for seam bowling, I would have assumed it's much harder to get caught behind, right?
Yeah.
And if the wickets weren't as, and we know they weren't as quick and they didn't bounce as much, it would be much harder to get caught in the slips in a lot of those places as well. So now, you know, what a normal test field probably has, what, 3 slips and a gully, or, you know, 4 slips, you know, when on day one of a test match. Some of those other fields didn't quite have that, right? They had different kinds of, you know, short leg was a automatic attacking position in some of those, leg slip, leg gully, those sorts of positions, which is very different. And so if you've got a leg slip and a leg gully in and a fine leg back or a deep backward square, wherever the other fielder is, that's probably suggesting you're bowling straighter anyway. And so you are bowling more at the stumps. And we know that bowling outside off stump becomes a big deal kind of in the 60s. So England starts to talk about the corridor at that point. In Australia, it's called the Queensland line. In South Africa, they call it bowling dry. And so we know that there was more bowling at the stumps, and then over time they slowly move away. So I do think it's not as simple as the wickets weren't as good, or perhaps the techniques weren't always as robust. And I do think modern techniques are probably slightly better. And when I say modern, I mean the last 30 to 40 years, you know, as an overall point. But I do think that the actual line changes. And again, especially as we go from probably up until 1935, 1940, I would have thought that bowlers were still hitting the pitch quite a lot because the pitches were still a little bit uneven. When Bradman and Hammond and Headley make all of their runs, it's like, well, you can't just keep bowling at those guys on these flat wickets. So you probably have to then bowl outside off stump with a stacked offside field. And then, of course, the fielding changes come in. So in the old days, up until 1955 or whenever it was, it might even be later than that, you could put you could have a leg slip and a leg gully and a fine leg and a deep backward square leg. So again, you could bowl straighter if you wanted to. And then over time, when you could only have 2 fielders behind square on the leg side. So I think there's a few different changes there. But I do think it illuminates something that we don't hear a lot, which is actually modern batting techniques, I think, are fairly robust. They might be more set up to score quickly now than they ever have been before. But I always thought it was funny that in the 90s, all you ever heard was that ODI cricket was ruining techniques. And then from 2000 to 2016, we had the best batting era of all time. And no one said shit anymore. there was an obvious mistake in that. But yeah, I think all those different things that we talked about before probably play a part in that. And if umpires aren't giving out LBWs as well, like now, I would say most seam bowlers now either bowl for LBW or caught behind, right? I would say those are the two ways that we bowl. And if we get a bowled from it, we'll take that. But we're actually trying to set this batter up for an LBW, or we're trying to get them to nick off. I think if you go back, I think there were probably quite a lot of bowlers who were bowling specifically for bowls, because if it's, what, 20% of the dismissals, you're bowling for the thing that is, you know, that is one of the highest, possible. And then caught in the ring is always like, well, not caught in the ring, but caught other fielder, wherever those other fielders are, is always the most dominant form of dismissal. So you're bowling for those two things, whereas now you're really bowling for the cordon and for LBW.
Absolutely.
I should also say that that's also spin. It wasn't just pace as well. Spin, the bolds have gone down quite a lot, haven't they? So it's right across the board, pace and spin from that. The other thing I just want to point out is I would say now that when you see a bold, it's actually quite an outlier event if you see a bold in a test match now, which is probably... It's funny, when I watched cricket in the 90s, I don't remember us being as excited by someone getting bowled. It was just a thing that happened. Whereas now, it's like everyone on social media goes nuts if someone gets bowled. So I do think...
Yeah, Reddit, there's a subreddit called Death Rattle Porn, which is basically just great bowled.
To be fair, in the 80s, we would have had that, except for the fact that we didn't have Reddit and we couldn't talk about porn as much. But stumpings... This is quite interesting as well. So without having looked at the data, if I'd asked you, what do you think your perception of stumpings would have been, more or less than the old days?
I think I would have just said less, because we don't see batters using their feet as much anymore, right? Because I think, like, in the ones that do are so good at spin that whenever they do use their feet, it's almost always the right choice. Yeah. So I think just by going with that, I think it's like, I understand, it makes sense to me. Like, I think even back in the day, from what I like heard you talk about it, spinners were much slower. So you had to use their feet versus, you could easily use their feet versus them. You probably also had a greater dismissal rate versus spin, because stumping versus spin, right? Whereas now it's like, it's really, it's almost impossible to use your feet to someone like Jadeja or Akhtar, right? I think that makes sense to me. Also, I was like weirdly looking this up recently. For some reason, Root is really bad at using his feet. He's almost like woefully bad, I think, from what I remember, versus spin.
Yeah. I think with him, we certainly have a situation where he is very good at sweeping, and he's very good at going back. But when he comes down the wicket, he gets a little bit lost. If you watch him, I think so. I forget his name, but I think it was Moeen Khan's brother, who coached Joe Root, and I think he probably realized early on, mate, if you sweep and then you come a long way forward when you're defending and a long way back when you're defending, you'll be in a much better position. So, yeah, you're right. What I found interesting is what we just said is broadly true. So up until the 1950s was the last time we had a high stumping rate. That was at 6.4%. And before that, it was always well above 4%. And I think, what's the record? 1940s, another outlier, 7.5% of dismissals. The 1940s by stumpings when you're talking about spin. But what's interesting is that no one leaves the crease in the 1960s at all. That's the lowest record we have anywhere. And then everything else hovers around, what, 4.5%, 5% from there.
Yeah,
from
around that, yeah.
And it's really, really noticeable to see that. But it's so if you look at the 90s is 5% and the 2000s is 5.2%. And it's been 4.7 and 4.86 since. It's pretty steady, right? It's pretty steady. And I would have thought, especially in this decade, we would have seen a bit of a dip down in the stumping ratios. But I think what happens now is when people come down the crease, it's very different to when they came down the wicket in 1980s or 1990s or 1970s. In those days, you often just came down to maneuver the ball. and you might even mm-hmm. come down to defend the ball. Whereas now, if you come down the wicket, you are trying to hit a six. So it probably makes more sense that you are missing the ball and still being stumped. And the other thing I would say is that the slog sweep probably has a few extra stumpings than that we, in our mind, we don't, it's not that we don't count them as stumpings, but we forget that in the old days, you didn't go out sweeping stumps all that often because you weren't trying to power it over deep mid wicket. You were just trying to get on top of it and hit it to deep backward square. Whereas now, you're in a power position and your back foot is quite often shifting as you're playing that. So I wonder if those stumpings have gone up and the stumpings when people are just trying to whack sixes have gone up. But what we've actually lost is quite a few of the other stumpings where someone's just come down the wicket to try and hit the ball through mid-wicket for a couple.
Yeah, I think also we see some instances where batters are like, okay, I have to use my feet, so I'll use my feet. I don't know if it's just me. Like they may not necessarily be great at using their feet, but they still do because they think they have to use their feet. So you almost end up with weird things where they don't look very good when they're using the speed. But that, I mean, I'm usually talking about England when I'm saying this. A lot of the times I feel like whenever England do use their feet, you're almost like, why are you trying to use your feet again? So it's like, it's a bit like a cricket game where they're like, they know one or two shots and they just spam it versus spin. So again, I think a lot of things in cricket I'm realizing are like are symptoms more rather than just causes.
Yeah.
You know, like England attacking more isn't the reason they collapse a lot. They're attacking more because they collapse a lot, right?
Yeah.
I think people just often have it backwards.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think with the spin, I think that's a good example of, so Pujara and Michael Clarke, I think it's in the CricBiz database or Optus database, whoever keeps account of this, have them as the two highest percentage of modern players who come down the wicket. They came down the wicket to defend, to attack, to pad the ball away, whatever they wanted to do. I can't think of a single batter now who comes down the wicket anywhere near the percentage that either of those two. So in one generation, you know, who have you got?
So I think Sal Shakil was pretty good at that.
Ooh. Do you know what? Yeah. The Pakistanis, I would say, they're actually very interesting in general. So I would say that they might be a little bit different. But I'd have to have a look at the numbers to see if he's at that level. But the point being is Michael Clarke and Pujara, the way they were batting was common beforehand. Right.
Mm.
And I remember when I was talking to Brian Lara for the book, and he was sort of saying that he struggled with India because their spinners bowl flatter and faster. And his thing was the minute the ball goes up above the eye line, my feet are so quick, I will just go out to hit that. There aren't many spinners left that you can do that with. Like the slowest spinners now are in the low 80s, right? Whereas the slowest spinners in Lara's period were still bowling mid 70s, perhaps, even sometimes low 70s.
He still had the Shane ones, right? He still had like Shane one. A kind of bowler, right? Yeah.
Exactly. I think McGill might have even been slower than Warne, if I remember correctly. But
they were even slow.
Yeah. I think there were even slow finger spinners back in those days, though. And if you go back and you look at Bisham Baity, like, he looks incredibly slow compared to modern cricket. And if you go back, and you look at Clary Grimmett, like, I'm not particularly great at using my feet. I can do it when I need to, but I'm a sweeper. I would back myself to get to the pitch of Clary Grimmett's deliveries based on modern cricket knowledge, even though I'm not very good at batting, right? He'd still get me out because he's Clary Grimmett, he'd bowl a flipper and I'd look like an idiot, right? And I wouldn't pick his wrong. But I would back myself to get to the pitch of him because he looks like a Sunday bowler, right? Like the way that he went. So you can tell that all that is changing. But I do think what that has also meant is we get different kinds of stumpings now. So as you said, we get the guys who come down the wicket because they can't score. And so they just have to come down and try and whack it. And I think those slog sweepers is the other one. Here's the last one. These last two I think are the most interesting because I just thought that stumpings would have gone down, whereas actually it's been about level, as I said, for 50 or 60 years. But the other one that I thought was quite interesting was runouts. What did you make of the runout data?
I was a bit surprised, I must say, because I feel like I see a lot of runouts in Test cricket for some reason. I don't know if that's just an Indian thing. Especially in this series, I feel like that Virat Kohli run out still scarred my brain. It lives rent-free in my head right now at this point. So I'm a bit surprised, but I do think it makes sense. I think some comments pointed out that maybe we're just more selfless or we're just better at running. The idea of what a good run is just better now, right?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. So basically, what was it? Around the start of cricket, we were looking at about 3-4%. I think in 1880s, there wasn't a lot of cricket played, but it was over 4% that year. And up until the 1920s, it was also still around that over 4% mark. And at the moment in modern cricket, we're at 2.5%. right? So that's a big, big drop overall, but it's just essentially just been coming down, except for our old friend, the 1940s, which has a dip for no reason at all, another outlier. But also 1930s is quite interesting. But yeah, so my thought was that I think running is a lot better now and that teams practice running now and they talk about running, whereas I don't think that was a thing before the 1980s.
I believe white ball cricket played a part in this, right? Teams are just, batters are just much better at maneuvering the ball into the gap and just taking single. That's one of the things where I'm like, I hate it when people are like, oh, people back in the day were just better strikers. I'm like, in what universe were they better striker teachers than modern batters, right?
Yeah, I think in the old days you would get, that was one of Australia's big advantages, I think, pre-war or post-war. And pre-war, there's not as much writing about this, but if you look at Bradman, I think it probably started pre-war as well, is that it was very hard to bowl six balls in a row to an Australian batter, right? Because they were constantly getting off strike. And it's trained into us as Australian players is the best place to bat is from the non-striker's end, right? And that isn't the case. That's not how England batters talk, or traditionally how England batters have talked. And it's not how other cultures talk as well. And you listen to people like, you know, Ian Chappell and Bill Laurie. And I know they were both great runners between the wickets. So it's partly because of the way they played. But they would say they didn't mind a guy who would sit on strike and hit one boundary and over off you because it meant that the bowler had six deliveries at you. Whereas in Australia, the whole idea is you've got to bowl three balls to me. Now you've got to bowl three balls to my friend, you know, and you're constantly changing your patterns and everything else. So I think you're right. So Australia revolutionized ODI running in the 80s, and that trickles over to Test cricket in the 90s. I think Steve Waugh plays a huge part in this, by the way, because I think he was probably one of the best ones at sort of combining the one-day method when looking for singles. You know, he sort of learnt from people like Dean Jones of when you defend with really, really soft hands. And I think it's in Dean Jones's book, he says, if you think about how far a cover fielder is from you, chances are that you're going to be able to run at the same speed of them if you drop the ball around your feet. If you have a look at Steve Waugh, he was really good at doing that on the offside or the leg side and just going, okay, I just think we can beat this person in a race. And so the old single guys, if you look at cricket from the 50s and 60s, what they're really doing is they're hitting the ball specifically into a gap and then taking one. But again, modern cricket players would look to turn that into a two, whereas those guys didn't. Mm-hmm. They just took the one and walked through. I think you're right. I think the people who make the comments about that as well. I think ODI cricket has played a big part. I'm just going to go out there and say that fitness is a big part as well, right?
Yeah, I think so too.
Because I almost think that when you play cricket and if you're tired, once you can concentrate for the next ball, if that makes sense. But sometimes after you've hit it, you're not fit enough to concentrate. And so, you know, we go back to the classic sort of Inzamam al-Haq days of he had no problem concentrating on each ball, but the minute the ball was hit, he almost had no interest in it. That is a form of fitness as well. But general fitness in that field, we just know how quick batters are now. And they practice running in their pads, which they never did in the history of the game. So I think all those things have played a part. And as you said, I think they're just better at judging a run than they ever have before. Because by the time you get to Test cricket and you're like 24 or 25, you have probably had to run a lot more than Jack Hobbs ever had to do. Because Jack Hobbs that wasn't the way that his game was set up. And then the final thing is, if you're hitting more boundaries now than ever before, that the percentage rate of runs from boundaries should be higher. So there should be less actual risks taken when you're running between the wickets because you're taking more risk when you're trying to hit the ball. So I would have assumed that also makes sense. What is interesting to me, and I'd be fascinated to see how you think about this, is this has been dipping for 140 years. Right, so the run out rates has basically been getting lower and lower almost all the time for 140 years. Does that keep happening, or is that it? Are we done?
I think it will keep happening until we reach the maximum theoretical speed that we can for cricketers, right? Obviously, we know Usain Bolt, I think, can run at, was it 40 miles per hour, or like 42, 43-ish, roughly speaking. So cricketers, not miles per hour, kilometers per hour, sorry. So I remember seeing Virat Kohli, Dhoni, they run at like 36, 37 out of their max.
Yeah.
So if you're assuming that just keeps going up at peak speed, I don't think it's sustained, but like still, if you assume that keeps going up, let's say we have a generation that can run a 40, which I think would be the max, we'll see it down and then we'll just stagnate. Until I don't know, until we just make like PEDs legal in sports and then everyone just starts writing up, then maybe we can see an increase. But until that happens, I think maybe for like a decade or two, we'll still see a decrease and then it stagnates.
Well, I wonder if it'll keep going in that direction, partly for what you've said. I also think we'll see more boundaries, right? So I don't know if we, I'm not saying running between wicket will ever go away. It's always going to be an art form, but I don't know if it's going to be as important in the next 30 years as it has been in the last 50 to 60 years. But the other thing is that pads have changed. And I think with technology now, like who was wearing the pads the other day? They basically looked like shin guards. I think it was one of the West Indian players or one of the English players came out with them in that T20 game where it was like, those don't look like pads at all. Like if you think about the, I remember, well, actually I can tell you this, coaching the under 11s, you know, last year and helping out with the under 11s, watching a young kid try and learn to run in pads is like one of the funniest things of all time because they don't know how to move their legs, right? Because it's a different kind of running. The closer we get that to a normal kind of running, right? And you don't have the extra weight. And so have you seen the new NFL helmets that are like soft rather than hard?
No, I don't follow a lot of NFL, to be honest.
Yeah, neither do I, but the helmet made news because the old helmets are hard. And it's, so you're banging, from that point of view. And the new helmets and the ones they're trialing are soft to stop concussions, right? If you think about that from a cricket perspective as well, and I'm not saying, I don't know if we can do it in cricket or whatever, but if we have softer helmets come on, the thigh pads and everything else become more contoured, there might even be a situation in the future where you can get sort of things melded completely to your body or whatever that may
be. Yeah, bats are also lighter, right? That's the new technology. Bats are getting lighter, right? That's part of it.
Yeah, so bats are getting lighter.
Yeah. Yeah, I was also going to ask you, like, are batters just better at turning now?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, like, that's maybe that also plays a part. Maybe we can just gain a bit of advantage if they get even better at turning.
Yeah, like, so I don't think before the 90s anyone ever thought about how you turned outside of which hand the bat was in. So that was the big thing in the 80s and 90s was, you know, make sure that the bat's in the right hand. So when you're turning, you can see where the ball is rather than having to turn blind. Whereas if you listen to, I think Dean Jones again, and he's a real pioneer in all this sort of stuff. And he talks about it heaps in his book as well. So he wrote the book in like 93, 94, and it talks about this sort of stuff, but coming out of the crease with power. And I've heard Johnny Bairstow talk about that as well. Johnny Bairstow is an incredible runner as well, but between the wickets and talking about how you get into the crease and get out of the crease. So I think you're right. I don't think any of that sort of stuff happens. So with the technology and the other thing is, again, to go back to the old equipment, and this was almost back to where we started with fast bowlers and everything. But if you look now, cricket shoes, So this is a cricket shoe from about 20 years ago, I would say. This is the Sachin Tendulkar shoe I have, right? This is an Adidas shoe from that period. And you can see it kind of looks a little bit like a trainer, but it also, it's quite heavily structured, right? Still like a bit like a cricket shoe. The cricket shoes now, I just got the ones that Kieran Pollard has. And they're like, yes, again.
I remember you sent a picture of it, right?
Yeah, I'm very excited about it. I haven't worn them yet. Thank you to Polly. I forget what the company's name is. I feel bad. If you search Kieran Pollard cricket shoes, you'll be able to find them. So I haven't worn them yet, so I don't know how good they are, but they look really good. But a lot of people, a lot of cricket shoes now, especially for batters, just look like sneakers with spikes on the end, right? And if you go back, I don't know if you've ever done any history about the 100-meter race, but it's really interesting where they think that we've got faster as a species over 90 years or whatever it is since Jesse Owens run. But actually, the big change they really think is the fact that the surfaces are better that we run on, the shoes are better that we run in, right? And then you've got fitness and understanding biomechanics and you know, wind resistance and all those sorts of things. But we don't actually think that humans have got evolved massively in 90 years to be whatever it is, a second quicker or half a second quicker. We think that it's all those little advantages. And I think it's the same with batting and running between the wickets is, you know, if you go back and you look at the shoes that Don Bradman's like trying to run in like, I don't know, what would you call them? Like wedding shoes? Like they're like weird white leather shoes. Like that's nothing like these. And these aren't state of the art. These are 20 years old. And it tells you how much things have changed. So that's why I did it. And that's why I did this whole thing, because I thought it was really interesting once we saw that graphic to be able to show this. It's something I've wanted to do for a long time, which is literally batting has evolved, or cricket has evolved through time to be a completely different sport. Is it? What was the thing that stuck out the most to you when you kind of went through all this?
I think like the biggest one, I think we talked about it, right? The impact of DRS, I think how much it's changed spin. Because we went from like batting 1 in 10 dismissals at LBW to 1 in 5 now. That's a pretty dramatic change for spinners. Spinners just attack the stumps way more now. They're faster now as well, right? So we see a lot of that has taken effect into the batters. The other thing is the very like last graph we did was the run. It's the run rate versus the average thing. It's like no one's making runs and everyone's just scoring quicker than they ever had. That's really fascinating to see it. I think, as I mentioned before, I don't think that's, people think that we have low averages because people are attacking more. I think it's the other way around. People are attacking more because we've had a period of 5 years when no one made runs. It's gotten to a point where like the pandemic has just ruined the base playing pandemic, not the COVID pandemic, not to be confused, has ruined people's perception to the point where everyone's like, oh, well, England just produced roads at home. You're like, their test matches are not lasting more than 4 days. I don't know how their roads. It's like very different to like the Pakistani roads where like, I think even I could probably score like a few runs on them. Right. So I was going to ask you, right, the question I wanted to ask you is, are we at a point where it seems like India will just go, we are scoring quicker than we ever have. We have the best bite ball talents in the world. Why don't we just go back to flat batting pitches? Our spinners will still be better than everyone else. And because we can score so quickly, time won't be an issue anymore, right? Because back in the day, it might have taken them 180 overs to score 600 runs. They could very well do it in like 110 or 120 now, right? They're so much better at scoring quickly.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. So I did a podcast, it's probably before you joined Good Areas, but it was a Red Inca and this guy was, I think he's an Aussie Rules football statistician, but he'd done a post basically saying that for the first time ever, ODI batting averages had gone above test averages, right? And there are two things that happened, of course, that we'd had a big boom in the scoring rates of ODI cricket, so that you didn't lose your wickets, but you scored quicker, so your averages went up. And at the same time, the pace playing pandemic had started. And what he was basically saying at that point was that, is it possible that one day batting is now better than red ball batting? And it was like, it's obviously a bit more complicated than that, as you and I know, but it's a really fascinating discussion. But you look at the way that India and probably Australia, and I know Australia's batting lineup's a bit more iffy at the moment, but let's pretend they're both strong batting lineups. And you've got Head and Marsh and, you know, those sorts of players in the middle. And you've got, you know, Pant and Jaiswal and even Rohit going strong at the top. You have the ability now to score really, really quickly, as you said. So make 600 off 110 overs and keep yourself in the game. That's never existed before in the history of cricket. And it's happening at the moment, when the average is about 320 runs per innings, right? So if you compare that to, I want to say 2012-ish, when it was around 40 runs per 400 runs or 420 runs or whatever it was back in those days, like it's a big, big drop from that. So is it possible that you go back to slightly flatter pitches and more even pitches and you do that? Or is it not necessarily the pitches? And is it now a combination of Indian spinners are bowling so much quicker that it's very hard to actually stay on those wickets, that this new seam on the Kookaburra means that there's always, even when you have a flat pitch, unless you have a Pakistani flat pitch, you know, there's always going to be something in it for the bowlers in a way there was before. So I think we're in sort of like a hinge period, because I don't think we can score that much quicker in test match cricket on the wickets we're playing. And I think if we went back to defensive batting, I don't think we'd see the averages go back up. Right. Like it's, as you said, that's the symptom. It's not actually what is happening. What is happening is batters got aggressive because they weren't scoring any runs to begin with. So now we're in a situation where it's like, I don't think modern batters quite know whether they should be attacking or defending. So if they went to your method and just went, we're the best team, we can score at this rate, we might see India, Australia, I don't know if there's another team that can even do it in modern cricket, but we might see another team as well just go, okay, that's what we're going to do. We're going to score 500 in 80 to 90 overs, and we're going to always keep ourselves in those kinds of games. But I just think if you see that, you'll see the opposite as well, which is the collapses will come back because there's too much in the balls and the conditions to be able to do that consistently anyway. So I'm not sure we know 100% at the moment what the next 5 years are going to be like, because if the averages are dropping and the strike rates go up, at what point do we see the complete opposite happen? Right. And, you know, Bazball is at once successful because England were a terrible team and they have more results and wins now. But also it is not repeatable, because when you're attacking that much, you actually bring you actually give the opposition such a chance to occasionally to whip you out. So do teams like India and Australia want to follow that method? Or do they want to go back to the sort of, I don't know, maybe the best batting in Test cricket at the moment would be what we see between overs 10 and 25 in an ODI, or between overs 6 and 9 in a T20 game, right? Where you're putting pressure back on the bowlers and you're showing them that you're coming for them, but actually you're just trying to manipulate the field and get a couple of runs.
Yeah, I think we saw two big instances of that recently. Right? One was Harry Brook and Joe Root in that, the Pindy Road, yeah. And the other was Sarfraz and Richard Pant, which is, I think, by far the most entertaining partnership I've seen in recent times. Like, it was just so fun to watch. Just both of them, just they're like very nervy runners as well. And on top of that, like, it's the ease at which they're going at 4 or 5 runs and over.
Yeah.
I think that's probably where we're going, right?
But I think that makes more sense for me, right?
Yeah.
Like, so, you know, you look at Rishabh Pant when he was younger and he would like see the ball in the footmarks and come down and try and hit it for 6 all the time. And you're like, I get it. I understand the basic point, but actually you're probably not going to go out to this bowling anyway. So why not just milk it? And then when you want to step, you know, when you're completely set and things are going well, step on the accelerator. So I think the last 2 years, perhaps, you know, as Bazball has taken over, we've seen too much people think that Bazball means slogging and hitting sixes, whereas it probably means getting the field out and then milking the field.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is me and Varun done for today. We'll see what the evolution is. If either of us, or if the planet still exists in 30 years' time, we'll come back and we'll try and do it again. But thanks for watching Footmarks. We've got a huge video on the main site all about this, which has all, we didn't use the graphics today because it would be too hard. Pressing buttons and everything, and but if you want to see all the graphics, you can see that, and there will also be an article up on goodareas.co. but thank you very much, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.